call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee order. Welcome, everyone. We will begin today by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2004, and I've asked everybody to be very brief in their comments because we're operating under very tight schedules these days. So, Chris?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2004 establishes the Oregon Political Party Fund. It allows a resident individual taxpayer filing a full-year tax return to designate a contribution to be made to the Oregon Political Party Fund. Each contribution may be up to $3 per taxpayer and reduces the amount of tax refund due. It is directed to the major, the money would be directed to the major or minor political party designated on the form and would require the Department of Revenue to list all major and minor political parties in the instructions for the return. And the bill identifies under certain conditions under which the designation would be considered void and no contribution made, and those would be basically when there's conflicting information on the return, and would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009.
Thank you very much. We're going to start off. We got four legislators coming by, but while they get here, we are going to start out with a panel, Zach Klonowski, Sam Klonowski, and Ray Welkeson.
Welcome. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, we'll do our best to be brief. My name is Zach Klonowski. I am one of Jim Klonowski's sons. I've had the privilege of working on this bill for the last couple of months and the honor of meeting with all of you. The time spent working on this bill has been a blessing because it has provided me with the opportunity to talk about my dad and keep his memory alive. On my daily drives up to the Capitol from my home in Eugene, I couldn't help but think of my dad and imagine the tremendous amount of joy he would feel from watching my efforts in the halls of the Capitol. He would have gotten a real kick out of discussing how my meetings with all the legislators were going. The dollar checkoff is designed as an easy way for average Oregonians to contribute to the political party of their choosing in order to improve the political discourse in the state. It gets more people involved and invested in the political process, along with raising funds from no-strings-attached, grassroots donors, donors who hope for nothing more than a more efficient and effective government. My dad always believed in the ability of an active, engaged citizenry to enact positive changes in society, and this bill helps engage and activate regular citizens. This bill isn't the solution to all that ails campaign financing, but it is a step in the right direction. Grassroots democracy is not just a good thing. If we are to preserve our freedom, it is a necessary thing. It is not a partisan issue. In the last two presidential elections, record voter involvement and turnout saw each major political parties win once. Making it easy for the grassroots to support the political party of their choosing and thereby both to empower that party and to reduce or even eliminate its need to go hat in hand to big givers who so often have agendas not necessarily in line with the common good seems almost a no-brainer. Reinstituting the checkoff offers a small but important opportunity to do that. The goal of this bill is to engage citizens and get them more invested and active in the political process. That being said, I sit before you as the first, and hopefully not the last, success story from this bill. In the last couple of months, I have found myself meeting with state representatives and senators discussing issues ranging from campaign finance reform to green jobs. I have learned about priority bills and gut and stuffs and all that goes into getting a bill scheduled for public hearing in committee. I met with the governor. But most importantly, I learned firsthand that one committed, impassioned citizen with help along the way can truly make a difference in our great democratic experiment, something my dad always told me. So for me, this whole experience is more than reinstituting the dollar checkoff. It is the final lesson in political science that my dad taught me. Thank you so much for the opportunity to meet with you all individually over the last couple of months and for the opportunity to address you here today.
Thank you.
Chairman Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Sam Klonowski, and I'll be addressing my brother's written statement. I apologize for not being in front of the committee in person today. As I'm serving the U.S. Navy and am based in Naples, Italy, I hope you will forgive me for offering only my written statement. My dad grew up in a different generation. Born in the 1920s, it has been labeled the nation's greatest generation for pulling the country through the Great Depression, defeating fascism, and rebuilding the world, setting a course for near continual prosperity that has lasted for the last six decades. His generation did not email, he never really figured that technology out, nor did he use Twitter, nor did it live in a 24-hour news cycle. But even so, or maybe because of the greater perspective that lacking these conveniences allowed, most of them knew that the greatest dangers America faced did not come from the other side of the political aisle, and that the challenges to the nation could be overcome if free citizens worked together. Maybe it is a simplification of history, but it seems to me that his generation fought not to win transient political battles as much as we do today, but rather they struggled over bigger things, to preserve and better our system of representative democracy and fairness and accessibility of the free market system. It was those battles that engaged him throughout his life. Perhaps it came from his use of the GI Bill, the legislation that allowed him to go to college following his discharge from the Army after World War II. But somewhere along the lines, he learned that investing in people, improving the quality of knowledge among the citizenry, is the highest calling one who cares about the nation and is the best way to engage in the larger battles that define America. It was the same GI Bill that allowed him to go on to get his PhD from the University of Michigan. Staying committed to that understanding, he became a professor at the University of Oregon, and over 41 years he invested everything he could give, everything he experienced and everything he knew into his countless students who sat in the desks in front of him. At the same time, a committed and active citizen himself, he immersed himself fully in a small D democratic process, becoming the chairman of the Democratic Party of Lane County, and eventually the chairman of the Oregon Democratic Party. But in a way, it seems different from how many think today. He did not imagine that he had a monopoly on the truth or that his political viewpoint was always correct. He may have acted like that sometimes in debate, but his attitude towards his students reveals something much different. I witnessed it firsthand watching the mentoring of a student he taught in the 1990s. The student was smart as hell, as my dad would have said. A young man from Arizona, I met him at dinner in Phoenix, where he argued that my dad's continuously and repeatedly proclaiming to us that he was proudly bringing his Arizona Goldwater values to the Willamette Valley. At the end of the dinner, as I left, I turned to my dad and exclaimed, "What the heck are you investing so much time in this guy, Dad? Goldwater values in the Willamette Valley? There's nothing you worked harder against." My dad turned to me and explained, "Jake, you need to understand. My life has largely been about helping people reach their full potential, even when I disagree with them. When they are intelligent and willing to invest that intelligence into the community, my life has been about making sure that they can do to the best of their abilities. It has been something to offer. If they have something to offer, I want them to see and achieve what they can." "Yeah, Dad," I answered, "but Goldwater values in Eugene." My dad smiled and said, "Well, the other half of my life has been about trying to set these guys straight. But you got to respect this guy's guts. I love having him in class, and I know the guy's going to go far. Most of all, my dad believed in the energetic and intelligent exchange of ideas, and that investing oneself into turning one's ideas into reality. I'm sure all of his students would vouch for that. It is that exchange and that investment, he believed, that makes progress possible and keeps our society strong. The dollar checkoff was the embodiment of that belief when he helped pass it in 1977. It was a way to allow citizens to easily and freely choose to invest in their democracy, and a means of giving resources without strings attached, to those who engage in the great debates of our time, in order to better raise the awareness of the citizens of Oregon. It was not a way for one's ideological side to gain advantage over another, but a way for all sides to share their ideas. It is my hope that the dollar checkoff's renewal will not only allow more citizens to easily invest in democracy, nor simply provide resources that enable higher quality discussion among political parties, but that its renewal will be a small step towards remembering that it is our free and forceful but still respectful exchange of ideas among an intelligent, active citizenry that advances us all together. That, I think, is one of the lessons of my father's life, and passing the dollar checkoff today will do an honor to his legacy, and for that I'm eternally grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, and please thank Jake on behalf of the committee.
Thank
you. Are there questions? Thank you so much. We have two of my esteemed colleagues sitting there in the front row. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I'll be brief. I was the chair of the Lane County Democratic Party when Jim Klonowski was just leaving that position in 1978 for two terms. Jim was the chair of the state party then after that, and I traveled to Portland with him a number of times, and Mo Schlansky was his worthy opponent, and I think Mo is still around and a worthy opponent in the Democratic Party. The dollar checkoff, I think, was a really great way to allow ordinary citizens to make a contribution to their party. What we're looking at now is a $3 checkoff, which I think is warranted because of the inflation. But I think it's a great idea. And Jim Klonowski, as you've heard when we did the memorial on the Senate side, a wonderful person, very dedicated, with his students and with the community. And he was an optimist who felt that things would be okay if we did our part. And I think that's the if part. You just can't sit by and allow things to happen that you don't agree with if you want to improve what you consider to be the conditions in life. We have to be involved, and that's what Jim taught, that's what he lived. So I think this is a great opportunity to remember Jim, and it's a great opportunity more than anything to give people a chance to participate in a small way just by doing mm-hmm. the checkoff. So I urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and Jim Klonowski was my professor in college. My beloved professor very much got me excited about politics and learning about myself and the world around me. These boys have done a fabulous job, and I call them boys because anybody younger, as young as my children or younger, are still boys and girls, but they are young men, and they have done a tremendous job lobbying this legislation. Both sides of the building, I see them very often every week. They always come by to say hello. They've done a good job of promoting this, why it should be in statute. Quite frankly, one of the things I'd like them to do is go back to the archives and find out what happened for this to leave the statutes in 1981. There's got to be a story there. I don't know what it is. I'm just kind of curious about it. But this is true democracy, and you get to choose which political party you want to donate the money to. It doesn't reduce, it doesn't cost taxpayers any money. It just reduces your refund. So if you choose to donate, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. And I think there are provisions in the bill for if it's a joint return, how that can be accommodated. And if you don't check off anyone, then the designation is void and no contribution is considered made. So I think what they are doing is a legacy to their father about how democracy is important to all of us, young and old, no matter our age, and no matter how active or inactive we are. I think it really puts it there in front of you and gives you that opportunity to contribute in a way that might bring positive change to our society. So I'm wholeheartedly supporting this legislation. I just want to really tip my hat to all of the children of Jim Klonowski for participating. And I know Jake would have been here if he could, but he's in Naples, Italy, serving our country. And I have seen all of the boys here at one time or another this session and just really want to applaud their work and their engagement. I had to chuckle when they said they knew what a gut and stuff was and a priority bill and all those sorts of things. That's little bits of lingo that you don't really learn when you're not around the legislature, and it's one thing they'll be able to tell their own children about their experience in the Oregon State Legislature in the year 2009. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may ask a question of the department, and also I'd be interested in the perspective. It seems to me that maybe we've aimed a little too low with $3, If we came back in February and offered maybe three choices, $3 would be one, maybe five, maybe 10, what kind of grief would that give to the Department of Revenue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Thank you for that question, Senator Morris. We've appreciated the willingness of the sponsors of the bill to work with us on administrative issues. We could certainly take a look at that, but one of the limitations we've run into is space on the form, and you'll notice that this is only for full-year residents because we just don't have space on the part-year and the non-resident forms. There is a bit more room right now on the longer form, the Form 40. It's possible that we could accommodate that on that form, and if you were willing to allow it only on that form and not on the short form, that's certainly something that we could look at. But between now and February, we could investigate that to see whether it's a workable proposal. We'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that if someone is motivated to check $3, there'd be a high probability they would check 5 or even 10. And Senator Walker, I don't know what your perspective would be or the sponsors of the bill, but it seems to me there are greater opportunities than maybe what we're realizing.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, members of the committee, I think the young men want their bill this session.
I understand that.
so I don't want to impede that ability, but I think... you know, it's kind of late in the session to make that change now and then send it back for concurrence. But, you know, we could try, but I think they'd be a little bit nervous about that. I think we should let the bill go, and then in February you could look at expanding that if it works. I think you're right, because I don't think individuals lose their tax credit. We do still, Madam Chair, do we still have the political contribution tax credit?
So as of today, we do.
You have not eliminated that yet?
Not quite.
I know you're on a pension with tax credits, but and rightly so. We should be reviewing all of them. But so it would still be a tax credit that someone could apply for on their tax return for the following year for whatever they contributed. And so I like the idea of, you know, $3, $5, and $10, but space is an issue. The department, this is new again for the department, and so perhaps we should try it this way. Of course, the department will have to redo the forms again, but you reprint the forms every year anyway because the tax law changes. So I guess I'd want the boys to answer that question, Senator, because I know they're nervous about sending the bill out and going back for concurrence.
Actually, the chair has opinions on this, and
okay.
The chair also would like to cut this short.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hatt.
I do like Senator Morris's thinking. I'd like to get him on my campaign committee. I like the way your mind
all right.
All right. We're all about making money here in this building. That's what we do.
At risk of being rude, this public hearing is closed.
All right.
We will now open a work session on House Bill 2004.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2004 to the floor with a 2004 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2004 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The chair will ask Senator Morissette if he would like to carry this bill. And I want to thank the Klonoski clan for their leadership on this. I don't think we would be here today without you. So feather in your hat, and somewhere someone's looking down at you pretty proudly right now.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to go back to our work session on, open up a work session on House Bill 2472 on the Betsy tax credit. And we had asked our good public utility commissioner, John Savage, to come and help us. And Betty, why don't you come on up with him? Because we had questions yesterday from the committee that we felt that Mr. Savage could help address. Welcome.
Madam Chair, for members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Savage. I'm with the Oregon Public Utility Commission.
For the record, Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Savage, did you have any introductory remarks, or do you want to just...
Can I start with a disclaimer, first of all, since the our three-member commission, I always have to do this.
Okay, yes, you certainly may.
For Chair Byer's sake. our three-member commission has not deliberated on this bill or any of the amendments, so we have not taken any position, so I'm not representing, speaking for the commission as a whole.
Correct. Okay. Well, we had questions yesterday that were that we felt we could use your help on, and I'm missing my notes here. Chris, can you help me out with? I know that one of them was kind of a sense of what other states offer in the area of energy incentives, and I know probably some of those are through the regulatory process that you might be aware of.
Madam Chair, let me start with sort of an overall picture for the western states. Is most of the states, virtually all the states, have what's called a renewable portfolio standard. 9 out of the 11 western states have a requirement that their utilities, their regulated utilities, have to get a certain percentage of their supply from renewable resources, and that percentage increases over time. And we have a bill that, you know, we have our renewable portfolio standard. I do not know every form of incentive every state offers for renewable resources, so I'm going to have to defer to Betty here, because she's actually gone to the, there's a national database in which they take a state by state, they have a breakout by every possible form of incentive that's being offered for development of renewable resources. And you have to look not just at tax credits, but grants, loans, property tax waivers and the likes to get a really apples-to-apples comparison between the states. So I'm sorry I can't answer your question
directly.
Well, that's
fine. I think Betty's done some research since yesterday. But while we have you on the stage, can you just give us some help on understanding how the tax credits interrelate with the renewable portfolio standards?
Let me step back before I answer your question directly. We regulate three electric utilities. We regulate Portland General Electric, we regulate Pacific, and we regulate Idaho Power. And they serve about 75% of the households and businesses in this state, so to give you a flavor. Every development that you're talking about here in the state of Oregon ultimately has to sell to a utility. That's how they can make money to be able to build their plant and continue to operate their plant. In Oregon, we now have a renewable portfolio standard for those utilities. I won't get into what the requirements are for our publicly owned utilities. We have other people here who can talk about that. But for PGE and Pacific, 15% of their supply by 5% of their supply by 2010 has to come from renewable resources. 15% of their supply by 2015 has to come from renewable resources. 20% by 2020 and 25% by 2025. And by the time that we're getting up to the 2015, 2020, and 2025 period, we're talking a lot of renewable resources that have to be developed just to meet the renewable portfolio standard targets here in Oregon. You multiply that times what's going on throughout the West, and one estimate that I've heard is just by 2020 we have to develop somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 megawatts, which is a very, very big number of renewable resources to meet these targets throughout the West that each state has developed. One of the big drivers of development, at least for our three utilities, is this renewable portfolio standards that they have to meet. And we encourage our three utilities to solicit supply through what's called competitive bidding. And all three of our utilities have a request for proposals out right at this moment in which they are soliciting bids from developers to bid in, basically on characteristics, on price, and other kind of characteristics of the plant. And then we want to drive them through a competitive bidding process, because we want to meet our renewable portfolio standards at the lowest possible cost for our Oregon ratepayers. So right now, if you're looking at development in Oregon, you're looking at, for these requests for proposals that PGE, that Pacific have, and that Idaho Power have, is that there is competition between development in different states. And that's, I think, what one of the issues that you're grappling with here is that, for example, if PGE goes out and solicits bid, it will get bids from potential power plants in Washington State. It may get bids from potential power plants in Idaho State, and it'll definitely get bids from potential power plants here in Oregon. Right now, each of our utilities have these requests for proposals out, and so I'm anticipating right now and that over time that they'll continue to use this process, this RFP process, for soliciting new supply. I can say, without going into any details, this is very competitive. We're looking at predominantly, I'm not saying it's wholly, but predominantly we're looking at wind-on-wind competition. And that it could be wind-on-wind competition here in Oregon, it could be wind-on-wind competition between Oregon and Washington, or Oregon and Idaho, wherever the development may occur. Three points I want to make, just sort of generally. One, taking a look at where we are in terms of our request for proposals, I'm anticipating, at least in terms of the demand for new development from PGE, Pacific, and Idaho Power, that we'll see a lull somewhere about 2011 to 2013, that we're going to see a rush now because we have our request for proposals, and then I'm anticipating you would see a lull. Second of all, in terms of the decisions that you're making, given the huge amounts of resources that we may develop, any changes that you make to the business energy tax credit, which affects the competitiveness of a bid for any development here in the state of Oregon, is may affect the timing of development over a long run period. I mean, we have so much development may occur that we could lose out now, but the same site may be developed 10 years from now if we need to meet a higher renewable portfolio standard. Third general rule of thumb here to me would be just taking a look at some of the changes that are being proposed is that there are probably some power plants or proposals where this wouldn't make a difference and others where it would, definitely, where it'll affect their competitiveness and their ability to compete against plants in other states. The main thing, I think, it's going to be a function of the size of the facility that we're looking at, the power plant, how big it is, the quality of, and I'm just talking wind right at this moment, the quality of the wind at different sites, and different sites have different quality wind. Some have stronger, more steady winds, some less. And getting to your first point, Madam Chair, is the competing incentives of other states. All of that will factor in into what effect would there be. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to whatever you asked.
Yeah, very helpful. Are there questions before we turn to Betty and maybe ask for if you've gotten any more information on other states?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I began a quick search on this. It is not a quick matter. Went to the Desire website, and each state and territory has a page on what they offer. Brief overview, appears that Oregon has the most comprehensive tax credit program, but other states have different utility structures. It is complicated. You have to compare all the various criteria to determine what the incentive is on a given project. It does appear that in terms of tax credits, Oregon's appear to be the most robust.
Okay. Basically, from what you found out, and it's hard to measure apples and oranges, so what I like to do is just break it down to actual dollars. So in the next biennium, we're projected to spend out of our general fund $142 million. If we adopt the amendment, the revenue impact is projected to be $100 million for the next biennium through the tax credit alone. Is there any state that you saw where you would think that they, based on what you saw on their page, is there any other state that is going to be spending $100 million in the next biennium for tax $100 million or more?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does not appear so. There are some states that have fairly robust programs, and they cap individual projects at maybe $2 million, I think, was the largest one I saw. There are a number of programs that cap their tax credit program, but I believe Oregon's is the most robust.
So you have programs in other states that have an overall cap, so they end up in kind of a first-come, first-serve situation. and then they have, there are other states that maybe have both caps, an overall cap and a per-project cap?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, and there are some that just do a cap per project or per site and don't show a program cap. It's all over the place, and to do a really thorough job of doing an analysis of this would take us a while.
But the biggest cap that you found is $2 million, correct?
At this point, going through, Madam Chair, with the limited time I've spent in it, yes.
And what state was that? Do you remember?
I think it's like, Madam Chair, I believe it was like North Carolina.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Morris, did you have questions? I know that you had a number of questions yesterday, and Senator Telfer, you did too.
You know, I didn't write them down.
I wrote them down, and I can't find them. What were you saying? Oh, right. I wanted to find out, while you're thinking of yours, the issue of the energy sold to California from some of these wind mills. Do you have any idea how much of the wind power that we have going now is being sold to California? And how does that work? How does that hydraulic work in terms of our own renewable portfolio standards?
Madam Chair, I don't. First, I don't know exactly how much of any wind output is going to California, or at least is dedicated to California. I'm aware of one development, I don't know if it's been built or not, in which they were going to build it in the state of Oregon. A California utility would get credit for all generation, but that the actual power would stay within the Northwest. So you can separate out sort of taking credit for the renewable resources from the actual flow of the electrons. In terms of our RPS, I think that what it's all saying, and let me make clear here, is that we're all competing for all of everybody's resources. I mean, so it's not just people sort of hunkering after Oregon's resources. Oregon's, I mean, I'll be blunt. I want the cheapest resources that I can get for our ratepayers, and some of them are in other states. So I don't mind going after, I mean, having our utilities going after development in other states. So I think what you have is sort of an overall Northwest market, and frankly, California is huge. They have a huge renewable portfolio standards, and to meet that standards, they need development from all over. To get to your question of what's its effect on our RPS, we're competing for sites.
You're competing for sites, but then when you look at the funding, at the financial viability of these projects, if there's that much pressure from California right now, wouldn't that in itself be an incentive for some of these projects, even without a BETC?
If they can get a power purchase agreement with a California utility, yes, they will have an incentive. Mm-hmm. I mean, that will provide an incentive. But I think that the key there is they have to get and work out the arrangements, and I'm not an expert on California's system. Is ultimately, like I said, every developer ultimately needs to have an arrangement with a utility.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, how do you provide incentives for these things to happen? It sounds to me, the way I'm interpreting what you're saying, is that there is enormous pressure through the RPS to have these projects develop, and even if they don't have the advantage of a tax credit or as high a tax credit, that they would, even if the utilities had to pay slightly more for the power, the incentive to actually build the things would still be there. Am I hearing you correctly?
Madam Chair, let me distinguish between short run and long run. I think, and this is the point I was trying to make, and I can't just, I'm going to make an arbitrary long run of 10 years. I think that what you're saying is true over a long, long run, or maybe a 10-year period of if we are going to have to meet these renewable portfolio standards at these higher and higher and higher targets, we're going to develop a lot of sites. And that will ultimately be a driver. In the near term, though, and I can't tell you what period that is, I think there is competition such that a site may not be developed otherwise if it didn't have this incentive. It doesn't have an incentive compared to other sites.
Okay, thank you. Senator, I think Senator Hass was first.
Thank you. Of the renewable portfolio states, you said there were 9 of 11.
Nine of 11.
Roughly on the same timeline, 25 by 25?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's everybody's got a slightly different number, and what I find, everybody tries to out-compete each other, so these have been changing over time. But it's so it ends up roughly, California, for example, is going to 33%, a big number. I mean, and they're 10 times our size. So roughly, yeah, I would, with some variation, we're all working off about the same targets.
Okay, if I may, Madam Chair, this. So that kind of answers my question that I was going to ask then, that if even though this energy is going to California now, it's not like once we get up to 25, that'll change and we'll need it. It sounds like it would just accelerate.
I assume that they have, and I don't know the details of this particular transaction. I assume that it's a long-run transaction with the California utility. There are people here who know far more about this than I do.
You're challenging the chair to guess which people know.
No, I'm just being honest, Madam Chair.
Are you done, Senator Hatch?
Yes.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we can't compete with, say, Washington, they offer more, and so siting facilities, actual on the ground, brick and mortar, goes to Washington, does our RPS goal require us to have it in Oregon, or can we purchase it from a state?
Madam Chair, Senator, we can purchase it from another state. There are limits on no development coming from, and I would need to, subject to check, from Canada for a certain development. But I think that if as long as it's in the broad western state footprint, that it is acceptable.
So then if it doesn't matter where we get it from, we're really talking about siting things in Oregon and creating jobs in Oregon, because if they're going to build it in Washington because Washington offers them more incentive to go there, doesn't affect our RPS. What we're doing is losing job creation by not being able to compete with Washington, because we're going to get the power anyway no matter what state we buy it from.
Betty, could you give us an idea about how our tax credit compares with Washington's?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I cannot tell you that at this point. I don't have the information on Washington available to me.
I actually looked up Washington myself, and they have a sales tax exemption that is going to go, it's 100% now, and it is going to go to 75% in 2011, I believe. Over the past 3 years, I'm looking for my notes here, I believe they've had $955 million in qualifying expenditures. So if you multiply that by the 6.5% sales tax, I believe you come up with a actual tax expenditure of roughly $65 million for 5 years. That was my research. So if you find something different, please let us know.
Madam Chair,
Senator Telfer.
Do you take into account the fact that they don't have income tax, and that's an incentive, and so people are buying or paying sales tax instead of income tax? I mean, it's a different tax structure. It's kind of hard to just take a couple.
Well, again, I'm trying to look for, and you make a good point, but I'm trying to look for the actual tax expenditure. In other words, the tax advantage that people have. Because we don't pay a sales tax in Oregon. We do pay in Washington. It's just the opposite. But if you break it down to tax expenditure, that's what my computation found in the state of Washington. And I might have missed something, so Betty, you're the expert. If you find something different about that, please let us know. Are there other questions, Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just occurs to me that we've kind of lost our way a little bit with respect to this whole issue of tax credits and energy production and distribution. Power generation and distribution is a regulated industry with a regulated return for the investor-owned utilities, and that's PUC's function. Mm-hmm. We have clouded this issue so badly with economic development, job creation, that we don't know who's on first, who's on second, and what really is required to make this work, to meet the 25% renewable. And it seems to me, and John, maybe if you'd comment, it just seems to me that, with that 25% requirement, within the regulated framework, that we would be achieving the least cost, and that's really our goal. And I'm glad that you stated that. That is our goal here, the least cost power, reliable power, to Oregon's citizens. And it seems like that we've just, that this is such a clouded issue that we've lost that whole focus of power delivery. And if we were allowed to, and I know the chair was advancing the question along this line as well, if we were allowed to just let this mature with that requirement, and we had very limited tax credits, would we be able to meet that 25% goal?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, ultimately, yes. I think the question is at what cost? And that's and also going back to the fundamental question about the tax credit, there may be other, and I'm, this is what you're going to grapple with, other worthy goals in terms of bringing down the cost of new technologies. It could be make, you know, jobs. You know, these are the other, some other factors that are built into this. This is not, when I look at it as a commissioner, I'm looking at to get the best possible deal for ratepayers.
Right. So to oversimplify, if you have a very generous tax credit, as we have, you're kind of subsidizing the ratepayers through the taxpayers, and sometimes those are the same folks, right?
Very much so, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Are there any more questions from the committee for Mr. Savage? Paul, did you think of any questions that we forgot to ask, or Chris?
Hit the ones that I had in my notes.
Okay,
I do have a question, Madam Chair.
Please.
With respect to the amendment in the proposal to change the conservation standard for those receiving a one-year credit from 10% to 20%, and I guess, Betty, this would be a question for you. Do we have an idea of how many projects that would affect?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we do. I actually tried to answer your questions via PowerPoint today, so if you'd like me to power that up, I can answer your question.
Oh, yes, thank you. You've been hiding this PowerPoint this whole time?
Which is hard to do.
Oh, okay.
So, what I tried to do here is I went back to our 2008 final BETSI applications, and we did a sort on our database and pulled out all the applications for projects that were between 11 and 20%, and showing it by system type, the number of applications, and the final cost. So this is the final certificate cost. Okay, this isn't the tax credit amount. This is the final certificate cost. So when you look down these projects, there's a big one, and that's the efficient truck technology, which can vary greatly. So this is about 304 of 2,100 conservation applications, so that's about 19-20% of the applications would fall out.
Oh, these would all fall out? Does that include all of the truck technology?
Not all of the truck technology, but some of the truck technology. Some of the concern voiced was that when you do a 20%, the increase to 20% for incremental improvements, for example, when you're doing a boiler, standard's 80%, you have to be 10% above code in a new building, or if you're doing a renovation and you have to meet new code. So you're going to struggle with some of these technologies. So, for example, in a boiler modification, not all boiler modifications would fall out. Some would. In the ones that are on the edge, you would be required to do a more comprehensive approach using some kind of a control strategy. Controls, again, might have to be matched with something else. So this is just kind of a, I wanted to let you know what kinds of projects would be impacted.
Well, I'm looking at the efficient truck. I mean, how many boiler modifications would you have? Is that two? Is that half of them or just a small handful of them? Or
I didn't break out the whole program for a comparison. It's not a big number in terms of the total applications. If there's 2,100 in the conservation projects, this is a few out of different classes of projects.
Okay, the one that really jumps out is the efficient truck technology. How does that program work?
This program is based on making improvements to trucks for the diesel idling, those kinds of issues. The efficient truck technology has been very popular, has had rapid rise in popularity. It has a relatively short payback, so it's a very popular
credit right now. So they're only achieving 10% improvement?
Somewhere in the, 10 to 15. It's a range of projects, and what we're doing was we chose all those that fell between 11 and 19%. So some of these may be at 12, some may be at 18%.
Because the truck technology, I mean, that's a case where, those are really pretty potent greenhouse gases that come out of the trucks and diesel particulate and everything else. So is that 187, is that most of them? Bob Russell here. Bob, would you come up? We had talked about this before. This is...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Associations. I was kind of startled when I saw those numbers. That's huge. One question that I had, when she says total final cost, is that the cost of the project or is that the cost of the Betsy?
I believe our final costs, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those final costs are the, I believe those are the final certification costs. So on the truck technology, it would be 35% of that.
That's what?
That is actually the cost of
the project. And you get 35%.
The Betsy's 35% of that. And Madam Chair, you may recall that back in March, I wrote you a lengthy letter with
Correct.
Pictures and all this different stuff where we apply for Betsy. In 2008, we earned about $6 million in Betsy tax credits. So you're eliminating about 20% of that program based on 2008's numbers. Although that program is becoming more popular, it's becoming more established. So it's been growing on an annual basis. And Madam Chair is correct. Because we're saving fuel, it's all the greenhouse gases that come from a diesel engine, and some are very potent, and more so than just carbon.
Right. So I'm trying to, and I'm sorry I got distracted here a little bit, but on the total number there, 187, is that most of them?
Madam Chair, I think just by a rough calculation, my recollection from the letter that I wrote you that in 2008, we did about $6 million in Betsy tax credits. So if 35% of that is what's impacted, you're roughly 20%, if my math is correct, is what you're reducing of the truck Betsy program.
Okay, and do you have any idea what would happen if we moved it like to 15% or something? Are you down close to the 10% or closer to 20?
Madam Chair, there's such a wide variety of projects. For example, sometimes it's as little as a diesel-fired heater that heats the cab of the truck when the driver sleeps during the wintertime, but that keeps the truck from idling. all the way up to fairings and low rolling resistance tires, auxiliary power units, the side skirts on trailers, even boat tails on the back of the trailers to increase the aerodynamic efficiency. So there's a variety of different technologies that apply, and each project is unique. Because what happens is you do an analysis of the type of operation and which of those technologies are appropriate for that type of trucking, basically. And that's what gets installed. So there's no cookie-cutter approach. You may recall that Cascade Sierra Solutions is the company that basically works with us to install all of these things on our trucks.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of a follow-up on that, this is all based on basically historic information.
Correct.
So did I hear you say that the actual, those that might want to participate, that demand is growing as it catches on, so that 20% might be a low figure compared to what in the future it could be?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, that's absolutely correct. The data that I got from the Department of Energy, I believe, was 3 years of data. And it started out in the hundreds of thousands, and by the end of that period, it had grown to 6 million. It was showing a steady growth. Part of the reason for that growth is this company, Cascade Sierra Solutions. They started out at the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority, and then Sharon Banks was just installing APUs on trucks. But what she discovered was a really good idea. So now she's opened storefronts, and her goal is to have them from Canada to Mexico. She now has one in Coburg, one in Portland, one in Sacramento. She's opening soon in Seattle, then in Medford. And as she opens these storefronts, which are at truck stops, and so it's readily accessible to us, that's creating the marketing that's expanding the program and making it successful.
Thank you. I guess my question, you probably can't answer this, is if we raised it to 20%, whether your program would be able to adapt to that and still take advantage of it.
Madam Chair, my biggest concern at this point, having just seen the numbers a few minutes ago, is its potential impact on Cascade Sierra Solutions. This is part of their business plan, are the Betsy tax credits that makes that whole thing work. And basically what you would be doing is significantly reducing their revenue. And what that does to that operation, I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, I guess my question was whether they would be able to change their business plan to comply with the 20% and still get the revenue.
Madam Chair, it depends on the type of operation of the truck. If you're talking a long-haul highway truck, and then the fuel savings is significantly more than 20%. But if you're talking something, a truck that stays within the state of Oregon, operates part of the time on highway and part of the time in pickup and delivery service on city streets, then the actual fuel savings is going to be less. So if you think about all the things that a truck does, those trucks that are operating at highway speeds, the higher percentage of the time, that the savings is going to be much greater, and it's going to go down based on the amount of time that's not spent on highway at highway speeds. If that makes any sense.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Is there any other questions from the committee?
I just have one for
Senator Morris.
Mr. Savage. In the language that we have in the dash 30s with respect to the Department of Energy and the PUC and OECDD looking at the, you know, essentially the financial parts of this equation, we discovered yesterday the last sentence, the purpose of the analysis will be to determine the extent to which each facility depends on state tax incentives to continue operation, which really didn't reflect, I think, the intent. And I believe our suggestion would be to maybe insert a reference to the initial investment and then continuing operations. And I suspect that would find favor with you folks.
You want to, we don't record nods on the record.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, yes.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Senator Telfer.
I was trying to remember all the questions that we asked yesterday that we were looking for follow-up, and
I have more slides.
Pardon?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I do have more slides. This was the first in my...
Sorry, continue. Sorry.
Okay. So when we were talking about Betsy, one of the questions the committee had was, what's the impact? What have we seen happening? So on the conservation, to continue on with conservation, tried to give you sort of a relative show of what Betsy is doing over time, comparing number of applications received and how that's progressing through the years 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, showing the number of applications received in the first column, the number of applications that are pre-certified, and the number of final applications. Then when you look at what is the impact in terms of dollars, again, you can see that over time, 2006 was when you had a $10 million limit and a 35% tax credit for renewable energy. You can see the number of applications and the dollar value increased sharply in 2007. You had two things occur in 2007. You had the RPS and you had the 50% Betsy. So you can see how the costs have changed. 2009 is what's been done to date. So you also asked what the backlog was in reference to if you were going to do a pre-certification date in the bill or preliminary applications. So here is sort of a breakout of what is in our backlog to date.
Betty, before you go on, what do you consider a backlog? Is that before pre-certification or is that...
Madam Chair, these are applications that have been received but not yet pre-certified. So when you look at the numbers on the renewable side, these are the costs, when we say eligible costs, these are the costs that come in on the application. It may exceed the cap, but this is the cost that the customers have said when they apply, this is how much the project costs. So there's a number of photovoltaic projects, six wind projects, renewable manufacturing projects, total 68 renewables projects, which could potentially be impacted by that date that you choose. 368 on the conservation side, so a total backlog of 436.
Madam Chair.
Senator Telfer.
Before you move on, because that was one of the questions I had asked, and you had said yesterday that generally it's 30-day application period,
mm-hmm.
and because of this backlog, you're now, what did I write, 60 to 90 days? How many on there are over 90 days?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, probably
just
a number
a little
of them.
Correction, it's Telfer.
Telfer, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not sure I didn't pull them by date, but a number of them would be older than that.
And so follow-up.
And
so many cases, these have to be done and on the ground and operational within 12 months. So if I've got something that's at least 3 months there, I don't have a lot of time, so I'm apt to expend some money before I get my pre-certification, just because of the time, the backlog, and the time frame that's taking place. Does that make sense? Because you said nobody should ever spend any money prior to pre-certification.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, on the photovoltaic projects right now, I don't believe any of our photovoltaics are out that far. Last summer, we had a huge crunch of applications, and we were hugely backlogged. At this point, I believe the photovoltaic applications, which are the ones that have a one-year limit for completion on construction for a privately owned system or 3 years for a publicly owned system, I don't think any of those are in the case where they would, they're beyond the 90 days at this point.
So for clarification, so what you're telling me is that there still shouldn't be any reason somebody would pay pre-certification expenses payout under this.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the issue of spending money to develop a project is a common one. If you're doing a conservation project, you may be doing an energy study ahead of time. If you're doing a renewable project, you may be spending funding to determine your siting, whatever, ahead of the project. Does that impact your project cost? Your project costs are supposed to be based on that application date.
Since this is a low, I'm looking for a little clarification on the answer you just gave me. If I have a $200 million project, you know, most of the $20 million grant or credits are over that. I'm certainly going to spend a year and a half prior to submitting an application expending money and large dollars before I start to put this package together. So I guess I was looking for clarification when you said those that have done that. And what I'm getting at in this bill is I want to make sure we don't kick somebody out of the system who's got some sense of certainty that they were going to get this credit, and so they've moved forward and expended large dollars. And so these $20 million credit projects, these are huge projects that do take one and a half years prior to actually submitting the application of doing feasibility studies and lots of different costly processes that I just don't want to see kicked out of the system because of the date that we pick in the bill. You know, the effective date or...
Madam Chair, Senator, I think this business of renewable energy generation that we've discussed, and a lot of it's been around wind, is very complex. You have state incentives, you have federal incentives, you have accelerated depreciation. It's been a very fluid process. The production tax credit has sunsetted and been extended on the federal side. So some of these credits have revolved, evolved, and changed over time. There are folks who I'm sure are looking at development of sites and systems, and they are banking on Betsy or the production tax credit or taking that production tax credit as a 30% grant. All of those are considerations in the business model and the finance model.
Well, but the people who started a year ago had no idea they were going to get the federal credit turned into a grant. Isn't that correct? I mean, they get a bonanza from the federal credit. So... You know, how much, I guess what we're trying to get at is how much do we owe people and when do we owe it? You know, I mean, this is not an entitlement, it's a tax credit. And so we're trying to figure out what's a reasonable cutoff if we change the tax credit. Or if anybody who's spent a dime is entitled to the full tax credit the day they spent their first dime, then we can't do anything. Because... that wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't help. So, because there's probably people who haven't applied yet who've spent money.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, whenever you change a program, picking the effective date is critical, and it's always a hard decision. You know, you pick a date, it's a policy decision on what date you pick. I understand the concern not to leave people out in the cold. I think that's a concern with doing the preliminary certification date as of June 1st as opposed to like an application date.
Madam Chair, I wasn't trying to say when somebody paid the first dime. What I'm looking for is, in order to make these decisions, I'm looking for some verifiable, credible data in which to base this. And I'm not getting the same answer. And so I'm confused as to what the basis on which I'm going to try to make these decisions is. I'm just trying to get some clarification from what you said yesterday and what you're saying today. So, and because I did spend a little bit of time yesterday doing a little bit more research and discussions and got a little bit more insight into some things. So I'm not saying we have to reimburse or give somebody the opportunity to get a credit on every dime they've spent, but I'm trying to get a better basis and understanding on what would be a good date.
Let's do some more research in that and try to pick something that would make sense. Also factoring in the change in the federal credit, because these projects apply, they qualify for federal credit plus a state credit, correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the federal production tax credit is not new. What is new is under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, they have allowed folks to take a 30% grant.
But
so basically an upfront credit for that. So that's what's new.
Yeah, and that has value. I mean, that has the time value of money.
Okay, Senator Morris.
I hate to keep asking these questions, but John, you referenced that the investor-owned utilities have tendered bids for power, the RPS power. Do we have anybody that's caught in that situation of having responded to a bid under the terms that are presently in place for credits that would be compromised and create a legal snafu problem?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, the information in the RFPs is confidential. I don't know. I am guessing that some of the, this is assertion only, I am guessing that some of the people that are in that backlog have bid in to different RFPs. That's all, but I don't have any details. I mean, I'm blinded from, from who's involved in the RFPs.
The more questions we ask, the worse this gets.
Well, ultimately, they come to us with a short list. I'm just saying right now, of all the bidders, I do not have information on the bidders or specific information about those bidders.
While he's pondering that, to go back up there to wind, you got $43 million. So is that $7 million in Betsy's that are being applied for each project?
Madam Chair, this is the total number of projects that are in and the total eligible costs. There are a number of very small projects in this particular batch that are in here. I did this by basically aggregating projects by PV, wind. I wanted to get you a flavor of what was in the backlog for your decision-making process.
Okay. All right. Senator Morris?
Well, if I understand it correctly, then, Madam Chair, we would be, these projects in this backlog would fall within the current law by virtue of the fact that they have been submitted, but they're in a backlog state and you haven't followed through the pre-certification yet.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, it's going to depend on how we do Section 10 in the bill. As it's written, it said preliminary certifications issued on or after June 1st. So these are in the backlog. By definition, their pre-certifications would be issued after June 1st. So these would be impacted with the current wording. If you were to change the wording to say apply to applications received by, then all these projects would be in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming. We may have you back again. We're going to get through this. We will live through this.
And for now, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2472, and I'm going to roll this over till tomorrow. We will take it up. I know there are people in the audience who have information to share, and but I need to get to at least a public hearing on our last remaining bill today, which is House Bill 2533. And at this point, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2533. And I believe we have a number of witnesses, and I will be focusing on the out-of-the-building witnesses today. Thank you. Okay, Steve.
Madam Chair, members, you have House Bill 2533, Ian Grost. Does two things. One part is dealing with small high schools. It allows small high school districts or high school districts with small high schools, get this straight, to qualify for additional student weights in the school equalization formula if the school has not changed location since 1995 and has fallen on July 1, 2009. This would allow what we thought were four small high schools to qualify. Based on some information received late yesterday, it's only three that have become small because of loss of students after the old effective date. So moving the effective date to July 1, 2009 would allow those to qualify for the additional student weight. The second part of the bill deals with the Portland School District, and it would allow the district to continue to levy its current property tax rate. That includes the old gap bond levy rate, and it would exclude that property taxes based upon that about 50 cent gap bond rate from school formula local revenue. And it would first apply in 09-10.
Okay, thank you. We have three people from Lincoln County signed up. Brenda Brown, Billy Joe Smith, and Brian Flannery, if you're still here. Thank you for your patience. I hope you learned all about energy policy. We want to see if we can get your input after this is all over. We need some fresh faces in this debate. We also have... okay, great. Welcome. And the shorter you can keep it, the better. We'd appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. In that case, I'll simply read mine. It'll be much faster. I won't ramble.
Okay, thank you.
So, thank you, Chair Burdick and committee members. Thank you for taking our testimony today. My name is Brenda Brown, and I'm the proud parent of two very successful Toledo High School graduates. I'm a member of the local chapter of Stanford Children, and I also serve on the Lincoln County School District Board of Directors. Lincoln County School District is somewhat unusual in that it is comprised of four very distinct and distant communities, each with a single high school. We, along with many other districts, have struggled for many years to keep our programs intact to prepare our students for success. The economic downturn and decreasing enrollment is affecting our small schools most severely, even to the point of impacting their very viability. And you'll hear more about that. The school funding formula in Oregon has been designed to establish equity among our schools. The Oregon legislature has recognized the need for extra funding for school districts with small schools since at least the 1940s by granting additional revenue to help provide an education program that meets state standards in small schools throughout the state. There are three, correction in my testimony, small high schools in Oregon that now qualify for this much-needed support but do not receive the support simply because their enrollment was slightly above the required number on October 23rd of 1999. It doesn't seem right that a school with declining enrollment is not adequately funded simply because it wasn't small before a prescribed date. The changes set forth in House Bill 2533 would not require new dollars, but is really a redistribution of funds. There are currently 190 small schools receiving this funding. The percentage of Oregon's overall funding that is weighted to all small schools is less than 1.5% of the entire statewide equalization revenue. This does not impact larger schools and districts unfairly, as all districts, including Lincoln County, contribute toward this weighted funding. Every child in Oregon should have an equal opportunity to attend school in their own community, to prepare for success in higher education, at work, or in life. You will be hearing of the importance of these schools to their students and their communities. And in an effort to demonstrate to you folks the importance of these small schools, both the Lincoln County School District Board of Directors and the City of Toledo City Council have adopted resolutions in support of what was then House Bill 2558 and have both supported the revisions and support the current bill, 2533.
Thank you. And Ms. Smith, we have your prepared testimony. If you could be even shorter, that would be great.
I will be, because as I listened to Brenda, I realized I was saying some of the same things. You
perfect.
Don't need to hear them again.
Can you identify yourself
yes.
for the record?
I'm Billy Jo Smith, and Chairman Burdick and members of the committee. I'm happy to be here. I'm also a member of Stand for Children, but I'm a former school board member and a former educator as well. And I've been working really for the past 2 years on the small rural schools funding because I saw through research that I'd been looking at about Oregon and around the country that there was a real need to bring these schools up to the point where they can offer good standard programs for their students in the rural school districts. One of the things that happened along with Measure 5 was that we had a lot of have and have-not districts in the state of Oregon. And as a result of Measure 5, which shifted a lot of the funding, as you're well aware, to the legislature from the local districts, we also set the stage for a greater degree of equity, which essentially means fairness between our schools. And it's your responsibility, really, to assure that our schools continue to receive equitable funding. And this weighted funding formula is a research-based thing that definitely does do that. And so I'm really speaking in favor of that. One of the other things, the research report that came from the Oregon Legislative Revenue Office this last fall stated that the total statewide school-rated revenue distribution for the rural schools is less than 1.5% of the total statewide distribution formula. Adding these new high schools, it will still be below 1.5%. It does not have a significant impact and thus would not impact the larger schools unfairly. The rest of my report I am not going to actually read to you at all, but I hope you will look at it because I have cited a lot of information, studies that most of them you can bring up online from the Rural School and Community Trust, but they cite what we ought to be doing with our small schools, the benefits of these small rural schools, and how important they are to their communities. So I hope that if you want to verify some of that, boy, it's all there, and it's very strong.
Yes.
One last thing I would say is a few years ago, and I'm from Toledo, too, an OSU economist was meeting with our city on its planning for the future. And I remember very vividly what he said. He said, whatever you do, don't give up your high school. It's critical to your community's future. And right now, our high school is in danger of being closed unless it gets this funding. So we ask that you support House Bill 2533 and all the wonderful values Oregon's small rural schools provide to their students and their towns. And thank you for letting us testify today.
Thank you very much. And if Alex Kyler is in the audience, I just want you to be patient and we'll get to you.
And I'm here all the time.
Are you here all the time? Well, then what we'll do is we'll roll you over with the other inside the building people to tomorrow so we can devote our time to the out-of-towners. So welcome to the committee.
Chairman Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Brian Flannery. I'm the principal of Toledo Junior Senior High School. Thank you for having us today. It is critical. This bill is going to be critical to the survival of our school and to the survival of our town. Our town really rallies around the school. We won an award this year for the community support that we've gotten for the school. Thousands of hours of community support this past year, painting the gym, new irrigation systems on our athletic fields. Our community comes together. It's about our schools. And found out this morning that you're having this hearing. I left ironically on a day that we were saying goodbye to several staff members that are going to be cut. And so I went around this morning to say, talk to them, let them know that I had to do this because I want to see if we can hopefully bring some people back and at least not lose any more. Also on the same day today, we found out that we have another $120,000 that I need to cut from my building. It is critical. We're at the point that we have 11 teachers currently for next year at the high school level, and with these additional cuts, we're looking at a point where we will not be able to get in all the courses we need for college graduation. And so I can't stress enough of what this has done over the course of the year. We've gone from the beginning of the year being very hopeful and lots of programs and new programs that we're starting, a cut midway through the year when we saw what the budget was looking like, and then another cut as we looked at projecting, and now a further cut. So I think all schools are in the same situation. I understand that. Ours is just more that we're on the edge. And a lot of folks have asked, well, why not you have got Newport close by, within 7 miles. What about consolidation? I think that you'll find with our school and with other schools in similar situations is that over the course of time, those schools, the class size ratio has gone up. Consolidation doesn't save you much money, and you create even larger issues when you try to consolidate. So we're in a really tight situation, or a very difficult situation, and like I said, it's not just about the survival of our school, but it's about our community, about small towns around the state. So I would really love to answer any questions you have either today or over the course of time when you're looking at this.
Thank you very much, and I'm sorry we interfered with your goodbyes, your sad goodbyes. No. To your staff. And thank you all for your support of your schools and your community. I've been into these small communities, and I know what a role the schools play. So thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Mike Sullivan can't come tomorrow, or so he says. Welcome.
No, Madam Chair, another round of golf for me.
You and Senator Telfer are going out golfing. I know that.
Actually, my son's got knee surgery tomorrow, so I won't be here. And I appreciate the time testifying from you and the committee. I am the political director for the association.
Can you give your name?
My name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. We have a local union down in Toledo. Local 13, and they're highly active in the community. There's a Willie Worman who heads up the Environmental Committee who did such a strong piece on what they do in the community that I asked it to be published in the Pacific Northwest Labor History, or Pacific Northwest Press, and it was. And it talks about the interaction between the high school, the company, and the union people. Cleaning up trails around the shore, cleaning the shore up. And in fact, when I was there last month, they were doing an effort to clean up the river. To take the face of the high school away from a small community like that is really painful. Things are depressed in the area. There is one major employer, Georgia Pacific, where Local 13 AWP PPW members work at. If you take one of these three out of the components out of the community, I think it may be fatal. I think the kids need to see a high school in the midst of their small community. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, and good luck to your son with his knee surgery.
He won't be playing golf either. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Questions? Thank you very much. We're out of time now, so tomorrow we will reopen the public hearing and take Justin Martin and Danny Hepper to testify, and we'll limit our testimony tomorrow to them. And thank you for your patience and indulgence. We will close the public hearing on Health Bill 2533, and we are adjourned.